This is one of those chapters, brothers and sisters, that has a number of little windows in it that open up our view to all the different facets of the work of God which he has purposed from the beginning. And it will be a most interesting night, I'm sure, and we look forward in anticipation to the remarks of our brother Brian.
Thank you, Brother Max, and my dear brethren and sisters and young people in our Lord Jesus Christ. I think we'll get straight off into this chapter, despite many things that have been happening in the world that were really worth commenting on, but we've got to get from verse 7 through to verse 21. And I suppose it was true again tonight, as we read that chapter, we probably thought to ourselves, my word, there's a lot of verses there, I'm not quite sure what they mean. Is that true? Quite a lot of verses like that, aren't there? And if you feel that you might understand that verse, you think to yourself, well, why is that where it is? What's the relationship to it before and above and below? So there's a lot to learn, as our brother Max has indicated. The way of the just is uprightness, we concluded last class. Thou most upright dost weigh the path of the just. Now, on our transparency here that Peter has very kindly put together for me, it's the same headings that were on that sheet that I gave out some time ago. On that transparency, we have those principal headings of the section we're dealing with. Verses 7 to 11, we have entitled, In the Way of Thy Judgments. In other words, there is a beckoning desire by Isaiah for the judgments of God to fall. And it's a prayer straight out for that. There's no hesitation by the prophet to ask for the judgment of God upon the world, that those that had waited for him might be vindicated in their faithful anticipation. And then in verses 12 to 19, the first part of 19 really, there's a statement that is in contrast to the verses that have gone before. That is, whilst judgment may fall upon those who have forsaken God and have not sought him in the way of his purpose and plan, which includes judgment, yet for these others God has preserved peace as a reward to them, though it may seem not like that at the present time. He has indeed ordained peace for them, in contrast to the end of those of the first of the earlier verses 7 to 11. And so, finally, in this glorious chapter, in verses 19, we say 19b, the second half of verse 19, to verse 21, we have just an exciting song, a jubilant song, where all the glory of resurrection and the life that it will offer comes through, both to the prophet Isaiah and to those of whom he speaks in that chapter. Yahweh's voice of resurrection, his determination to vindicate his people. And that's the summation of it. Yes, indeed, there's going to be judgments to vindicate the righteous. Absolute necessity of God's purpose, says Isaiah, and prays for it. But as for those that have put their trust in God and stayed away from the evil of the present world, then God has ordained peace for them. They'll not just be caught up in the melee of the whole judgment of God, but he will selectively give good unto his people whilst he brings judgments upon those who deserve it. And then finally we have that beautiful song of exaltation as God shows with his zeal. You know, the zeal of Yahweh of hosts is behind this resurrection that is to come. That's a glorious concept. We're in Isaiah. This is 1,000 years before Christ. Things, you might say, that they fit Romans, don't they, and so on. But here we are, 1,000 years before Christ. And all of this magnificent concept of the power of the gospel is there. What a marvellous book it is. A truly wonderful book. The little apocalypse, indeed. Of course, there's no, you know, step-by-step delineation that you're going to get in Daniel, and then later on it'll be taken up in Revelation, where you get that step-by-step approach. It's not that, is it? But the themes are similar, and the conclusions are similar. Directed against the great city of all the earth, the judgments of God, the vindication of his people, the disclosing of the blood, and the exhortation of Zion, in which a strong nation or a righteous nation enters in the grace of God. Marvellous chapter. So, the way of the just is uprightness. Thou most upright dost weigh the path of the just. They're in him, aren't they? If he is the most upright and their way is uprightness, they're in the way, aren't they? It's the only way to be. It's only a fool's head that would walk away from the things of God, isn't it? Because he's out of the way. That's not going to be the way that is adjudged by God to be right. It won't exist. The way of the righteous he knows, it says, doesn't it? In Psalm 1, I think the last verse of Psalm 1 says almost exactly those words. He's going to approve that way because he's upright. He's not going to approve the other way. Men think they'll get away with it. They won't get away with it. He's not going to approve that way. For Yahweh knoweth the way of the righteous. Psalm 1 verse 6. But the way of the ungodly shall perish. The way of the just is uprightness. And thou art most upright. Just weigh the path of the just. Isn't that beautiful? There's a statement of confidence in the right way. We need that, my dear and sister, today, don't we? That's why we can stick the paper down, we can put the magazine down, we can turn away from all those other things that are of no value to us at all, switch off the television, we can turn away from all of that with confidence and strength of purpose, because that's not the way. It's going to perish, and all those that take interest in it and put their lives in that are going to perish with it. The most upright has determined the only path for us to go. So verse 8, yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee. The desire of our soul is to thy name, to the remembrance of thee. We note the word waited, and we saw it earlier in chapter 25, verse 9, twice in that verse, wasn't it? We have waited for him. This is Yahweh, we have waited for him. When you wait for somebody, you have confidence in them, don't you? You make an arrangement and it's going to be here, and something might happen, but you wait because you know that that person is a person of his word and he will be there. Whatever circumstances might come, he will make communication at that point, because that's what he said. The arrangement has been fixed. You have confidence in that person. So to wait upon Yahweh is to express faith, isn't it? Confidence in God. And so, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee. When other persecutions came upon his people, they sat still and waited for God. There's some lovely expressions of waiting in this prophecy. Turn to the 31st chapter. 30th chapter, I'm sorry. In the 30th chapter, it says in verse 15, or verse 7, the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Therefore have I cried concerning this, their strength is to sit still. And of course reminds us, it echoes the words of Moses, doesn't it, when he was by the shore of the Red Sea. Stand still, he said, and see the salvation of Yahweh. Exodus 14 and verse 13. Verse 15 now. Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, in returning and rest shall ye be saved. In quietness and in confidence shall be your strength, and ye would not. People with their Bibles out, when all the world's rocking around from side to side, and there's upheaval and disconsolation on every side, there's a people that are as still and calm and confident as ever, because they've got God in their mind. Unshaken by all the turbulence of the world. Israel in this chapter were sometimes looking up to Assyria. When they weren't doing that, they're looking down to Egypt. They were like a silly dove. They didn't know which way to go. And God says, look, stand still and listen to me. In quietness, in confidence, I will save you. You don't have to rush down to Egypt. You don't have to tear up into Assyria, making one confederacy after another. And therefore, verse 18, will Yahweh wait You waited, he will wait. That he may be gracious unto you, and therefore will he be exalted, and that he may have mercy upon you. For Yahweh is a God of judgment. Blessed are all they that wait for him. You wait for him, he'll wait for you. He's got time for those that put their trust in him. Isn't that a lovely thing? I think God waits for us. If we're faithful to him and wait for him. You've got to wait today, don't you? Did you ever think we'd get to 1994? Can you believe that 6 months of 1994 is almost gone, my dear and sisters? What have we done in those 6 months? How have we progressed in the things of God in those 6 months? Would you like your record to have been written up on January the 1st or June the 30th? Have we made use of that time? Serious question. Mighty serious question. One of the best ways, really, to see if we're making progress is just to ask that question. Where were we on January the 30th in our stand with God? Where are we in June the 30th? 6 months slipped by without any direction in our lives. It can be like that, can't we? Or we can be drawing closer and closer to him and thinking more of his ways and of his purpose with us and our resolution to sit still in his activity. To sit still in his activity. It can be growing day by day. Psalm 119 has a very beautiful statement. See, this man is content in the judgments of God. I don't know that many of us dare to think like that so much, do you? I don't hear that expression very often in our, say, ecclesial prayers. Do you ever speak like that in your personal prayers? In the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh. Do we speak like that? There's a confidence there, isn't there? And if there's a confidence in the judgments of God, it means that we've sorted our own life out, doesn't it? Can't be confidence otherwise. If we've got one foot in and one foot out, we wouldn't have confidence in that way, would we? We couldn't. We'd be dreading the judgment of God. Psalm 119, verse 119 says, thou puttest away all the wicked of the earth like dross. Therefore, I love thy testimonies. You see, we don't serve God for naught, do we? We don't serve God because all the wicked of this world who are in high places are going to forever be the wicked in this world, do we? We don't serve God because he'll never ever do anything about that, do we? Of course we don't. But because he has said, this is the way and I will vindicate that way. That's why we serve him. Therefore thy servant loveth thy testimonies. Because God will arise. And vengeance will be his and he will vindicate the righteous in due time. So verse 8 is on the same theme in the second half. Isaiah 26 and verse 8 says, in a similar way, the desire of our soul is to thy name. And to the remembrance of thee. One translation, the RSV said, thy memorial name is the desire of our soul. These two words, which we have here, the name and remembrance, are always used in connotation with the memorial name. That word remembrance is the word seeker. And you have it again in verse 14 where you have the word memory. All right, seeker. Do you want me to write that up? These little verbal handles. I don't know what you do with yours, but I just pop them above the word itself. And when I see, therefore, down in verse 14, that it's the same word. By the way, that's an E. When I see it down in verse 14, that tells me something, that there's a little play going on with this word through the text. So, you know, it's worth putting that in. Observant reader next time will see the significance of that as he's following it through. Now, what does he mean? The desire of our soul is to thy name and to the remembrance of thee. That's a beautiful thought. What he's saying, my dear friends, is how do you feel reading this sort of thing in our world? He's saying, my delight, says Isaiah, it's a personal comment, it's Isaiah again, my delight is to think upon thy name. He's not thinking about that in sort of some abstract verbal manner. He means what that name stands for and all that's behind it. It's his delight to think about that. Here's a man, you see, that's absolutely given himself to the things of God. He is 100% devoted. Everything he's given has been given to that cause. And a man who does that surely thinks to himself, well, is that profitable? Has it been a wise investment to give my life to that cause? And the thing that cherished his heart and caused him to love his God and to find delight was that in God's name there was a purpose, there was a policy. Now, what was that policy? Of course, it does take us back, doesn't it, to Exodus. It's got to take us back to Exodus chapter 3, where the name was given. But if anybody asks you, you know, what's the thought behind that? The thought behind it is given very clearly in Exodus 6. It's, you might call, Moses' own exposition of the memorial name. And because of that, it's particularly helpful to us. In Exodus chapter 6, verse 2, we read, God spake unto Moses and said unto him, I am Yahweh. Right? So that's going to be up along that theme. I appeared unto Abraham and unto Isaac and unto Jacob by the name of El Shaddai, God Almighty. El Shaddai it is in the original. But by my name Yahweh was I not known to them. And I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. They knew me as El Shaddai, and had not seen me as Yahweh. I spoke to them about that land and about their children inhabiting it. And now I've come because I've heard their groaning. And I remember what I said to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Yahweh. Right? You want to know what that means? I'm revealing myself as Yahweh to you. You want to know what it means? Well, I want you to notice that that's how this section begins, verse 6. And in the end of verse 8, that's how it ends. I am Yahweh. Right? And there is furthermore, one of them in the middle of this section, verse 7. I am Yahweh your God. Right? Now, look at what turns up in between those two expressions. This is what Yahweh means. When he says that he took delight in remembering God's name, this is why he took delight. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Yahweh. You want to know what that means? I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage. And I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgment. And I will take you to me for a people. And I will be to you a God. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh your God, which bringeth you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you in unto the land concerning the which I did swear it, to give it to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And I will give it to you for a heritage. I am Yahweh. That's what it means. It's a God that states a purpose, and he absolutely is true to that purpose. I will, 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 saith Yahweh. That's what it means. Exposition by Moses himself. God means it. He doesn't say one thing and do another. When he says it, he means it. And that's why Isaiah loved him. That's why his servant loved his testimonies. Because God says it, and he does it. And when Isaiah was beset with all these problems, and people that were making life very difficult for him, and when he had given all his substance, and all his house, and all his children, his whole family life, was devoted to that cause, what if God, in fact, had been someone of treachery? What a terrible thing it would that a man should give all his whole life to God and then he treacherously deals with him. But he won't. And that's why Isaiah took great comfort in that. Look at his next expressions. How beautiful they are. With my soul have I desired thee in the night, verse 9. Here's a man who loves God. Loves him. With my soul have I desired thee in the night. What a beautiful thing. When did you last feel like that, my dear brothers and sisters, young people? When was it that the things of God so much bubbled in our mind that we felt like that with such intensity? With my soul have I desired thee in the night. There's a servant of God, isn't it? It's not a part-timer. Yea, with my spirit within me will I seek thee early. For when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness, and my cause will be vindicated, and my service to you will in fact have been shown to be right. Did you notice there that Isaiah's got a little pattern of life? I desire thee in the night, I seek thee early. That's in the morning and it's at evening. Got a little pattern in your life? Where do you think you might have got that from? Who had a little pattern in his life and told us about it? Two people that I know of. But one obviously followed the other. One did it in a strange city and the other did it in Jerusalem. Daniel, of course, was the one who did it in Babylon, wasn't he? Three times. The window came open. And that was a pattern in his life. An inbuilt structure of worship. Nothing wrong with that. A good thing. Very good thing. To have a pattern of worship. Little times where come what come may, you have a pattern, a structure to your life. Evening and morning and at noon will I pray, says David in Psalm 55 and verse 17. Evening and morning and at noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. Isn't that beautiful? Three times a day. A godly man, beautiful man. And we're not surprised, are we, when we read of David's writings and his knowledge of God. Daniel, the same in chapter 6, verse 10. And others, no doubt, many others. And here's Isaiah. In the night, in the morning. Here is truly a man of God. And then he says, and this confirms what we saw before. Why does he desire God and with his spirit within him will he seek him early? For, see, it's again based upon the fact that God will vindicate. He will judge. For when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. There's many beautiful passages to go with this, but particularly in Psalms 9 and 10. Would you like to have a look at Psalm 9 just at the moment? How's the world? You often think this when you stand there looking at people's lives and think, how the diggins, is the world ever going to turn back to God? Do you sometimes feel like that today? It doesn't matter what you read today, where you might see things, whatever. The disdain for the Bible is dreadful, frightening. It's frightening, my dear brothers and sisters. God sees all of that. The Creator and the Judge of all the earth sees all of that. Hears it. And men are getting bolder and bolder, aren't they? It's frightening. Very frightening. Yahweh is known, Psalm 9, verse 6, verse 16. Yahweh is known by the judgment which he executeth. Corollary, if he doesn't execute judgment, he won't be known. And they're saying today, aren't they, all through the world, as it were, where is the God of judgment? Go do what you like. If you want it, do it. You're the only one that counts. Yahweh is known by the judgment which he executeth. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands. You see, he thinks that he can go off and do what he likes, and God is unaware. In the Second of Chronicles, chapter 32, there's a beautiful illustration of this, in an early illustration of the fulfillment of this in Hezekiah's own life. And of course, he was the king at that time that these words were given. In the Second of Chronicles 32, verse 23, after the vindication that God gave unto his people in the days of Hezekiah, we find this astounding thing. Many brought gifts unto Yahweh to Jerusalem, and presents to King Hezekiah of Judah. so that he was magnified in the sight of all the nations from henceforth. Yahweh is known by the judgments which he executeth. In one night, 185,000 fell before the walls of Jerusalem. Yahweh is known by that, and the next minute all these presents are coming from the lands of the Gentiles to King Hezekiah. He was magnified in the sight of all nations from henceforth. That was a wonderful vindication of Isaiah's principle so beautifully enunciated here. And it, sorry, Peter? Yes. Yeah, read it, Pete. That's an excellent quotation.
Be strong and courageous. Be not afraid and dismayed for the king of Syria, nor for all the multitude that is with him, for there be more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is Yahweh our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people rested themselves on the words of Hezekiah.
That's lovely. Yeah, that's right. So if we've got a different way of life in the world in which we live, then be happy with it. Happy with it. Rejoice in it. Build on it. Have confidence before God for the way that we have. We don't have to change in our lives to accommodate a world that's warming up for Armageddon. Another little expression in the New Testament this time, Revelation, the last book, chapter 15, verse 4. Revelation 15 and verse 4. Great and marvellous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee? That's the question, isn't it? Who shall not fear thee, verse 4, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest. That's why. That's exactly what Isaiah said. When thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. And then he says this in verse 10. Let favour be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly, and will not behold the majesty of Yahweh. So verse 10 is saying it can't simply be done just by goodness, by kindness. It just can't be done like that. It needs the judgments of God. But when they are there, the inhabitants of the earth will learn righteousness. And my word, can't you feel that today? When those beautiful rains started to fall upon the earth in this time when men were desperately in need of rain, didn't you feel like that, my dear brothers? Could you understand why God gave rain to this generation? Can you understand that? Would you and I do that? To people that were treating us like this world treats him? Right from the very top to the bottom, isn't it? Prince Charles says, I don't want to be any longer the defender of the faith. Just of faith. Faith in anything. Faith in Buddha, if you like. Faith in the Hindus. Defend what? And that's the highest man of the land. Right down to the common people whose language is hardly repeatable. That's the same right through our society, isn't it? Look at the blessings. Never, ever been a generation. So he says in verse 11, Lord, when thy hand is lifted up, they will not see. That is to say, they will not want to see. But when the judgment of God is sufficiently sore upon the earth, then they shall see. When thy hand is lifted up, they will not see, but they shall see and be ashamed for their envy at the people, their envy of the people. Towards thy people, says my margin. Yea, the fire of thine enemies shall devour them. So, verse 11 is saying that those that came against God's people really knew that what they were doing was wrong. Do you know, I believe that's largely true in our world even today. I do believe that. I believe that it is given to man to know what's right and wrong. Even if he doesn't want to register his association with the Bible or with God's name. Yet there is, because he was created in the image and likeness of man, there is a facility, isn't there, that he knows that that is the right way and that's the wrong way. I believe that people too know that the Jewish people are in some way, however vague they might see it, they are in some way related to the book and the purpose of God. I do believe that. When Europe has heaped its vindictive arrogance and brutality against the Jewish people, I don't think that's been done entirely. There's a resentment because they are related to the book. You can't know the Bible, can you? You can't know anything about the Bible except you find it's all about Jews. And Jesus was a Jew. And he's the son of Abraham, Isaac. You can't know anything about the Bible unless you know that. Why then do they take on the Jewish people and seek to ridicule them? Why is that? Why that nation, above all other nations? Why that nation? They shall be ashamed for their envy at the people, towards thy people. And the same thing, I'm sure, means that they know too, that the way of life that we keep, they know that it is right and that it will be vindicated in due time. In the Psalms again, I mentioned Psalms 9 and 10. We're very close to this theme. There's something to remember, boys. Psalms 9 and 10. When you go home tonight, read these two Psalms, right? Good little exercise. And you'll see how remarkably in line they are with what we're looking here in Isaiah. Remarkably so. Thrillingly so. Just a little section now. Psalm 10. Psalm 10, verse 11. To 18, reasonable section, I suppose. He hath said in his heart, God hath forgotten. He hideth his face, he will never see it. Arise, O Yahweh, O Ael, lift up thine hand, forget not the humble. Wherefore doth the wicked contemn God? Oh, what relevance these words today. He hath said in his heart, thou wilt not require it. Thou hast seen it. For thou beholdest mischief and spite, to requite it with thy hand. The poor committeth himself unto thee. There's the Isaiah and the poor and needy of his chapter. Thou art the helper of the fatherless. Break thou the arm of the wicked and the evil man. Seek out his wickedness till thou find none. Yahweh is king for ever and ever. The heathen are perished out of his land. Lord, thou hast heard the desire of the humble. Thou wilt prepare their heart. Thou wilt cause thine ear to hear and to judge the fatherless and the oppressed, that the man of the earth may no more oppress. Isn't that beautifully similar, isn't it, to what we have here in verses 7 to 11 of Isaiah 26. Just a little note. You know the last phrase of verse 11? Yea, the fire of thine enemies shall devour them. It's a bit hard to work out what that's saying, isn't it? Yea, the fire of thine enemies shall devour them. You would have thought that it would devour the enemies, wouldn't you? And that's what it does mean. The RSV puts it, the fire shall devour the enemies. And that changes the sense to what, in fact, does make sense, doesn't it? Want me to read that again? The fire shall devour the enemies. So that section becomes understandable. Now verses 12 to 19a, under the title, Yahweh wilt ordain peace for us. It's the opening phrase. Yahweh, thou wilt ordain peace for us. For thou hast also wrought all our works in us. Oh, that's a beautiful verse. Where's the peace come from, my dear brothers and sisters? In the context, verse 3a. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace. His mind is stayed on thee. And it will go on, won't it? Not only now, he's got peace now, but it'll go on. The satisfaction, hope, realization of all the goal that we have. Peace will grow and swell. The increase of his peace. There shall be no end, says Isaiah's 9th chapter, doesn't it? Verse 7, Yahweh, thou wilt ordain peace for us. When all this judgment has come, see the point? The glorious contrast with the succeeding verses 7 to 11. For the unrighteous, fire. For those that waited in integrity, thou wilt ordain peace for us. And then as a reason why God would give peace, why he has ordained peace for us, must be that, says Isaiah, he says, for thou also hast wrought all our works in us. What does that mean? Thou hast also wrought all our works in us. I'll tell you what I believe it means. It means that God works with us in our lives. So take, for example, this very synonymous passage. It's a New Testament passage in Philippians. Philippians chapter 2, verse 12. Thou hast wrought all our works in us. God is working in our lives. If he's working in our lives, he's not going to see that end in a note of tragedy and judgment and ruin, is he? Thou would ordain peace for us, for thou also hast wrought all our works in us. God's working in our lives. In Philippians chapter 2 and verse 12, wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. That's a powerful thought, isn't it? God is working in our lives. There are some who would say that God does not work with our minds. That's not true. It just simply is not true. There are just too many passages of the Bible that say that if we seek God in our contemplation of his word and in our life, that he will help us. James chapter 1, verse 5. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. What does he say? Get back to the word, don't ask me for help. He doesn't say that, does he? Of course he doesn't. If any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who giveth liberally. And there'll be a million Bible students that have had that sense of wonderful appreciation when they've spent a night or an hour or a half an hour, whatever it might be, in the word of God and gone away a different man. What do they say? Wasn't I a smart Bible student? Or do they have a sense of deep thankfulness to God? And where that mingling is between the divine and the human, my dear friends, nobody can draw a line through that. To wrap it up in a little formula that God can help us only by the word and by angels is something that just simply is not in our prerogative to do whatsoever. Who said you can say that God can only do that? If I had a bad leg, would I not pray that God might help me? If I had a bad heart, would I not do the same thing? If I had a bad chest, would I not ask that he help me? And would he not help me, or could he not? Of course he could. What stops him going past the neck? It's a silly concept. It's not worthy of the many passages of Scripture which show that God does work with us in our lives. But the chairman tonight, in opening this meeting, ask that God might be with us as class members and as speaker and reader. What do we say? That he doesn't? We go home and say that God was not at the meeting. Only the Bible was at the meeting. God was not there at all. It's not right. The right thing is that there's a cooperation, and there's 100 passages of Scripture that are like that. And I can well remember Brother Mansfield, when this matter was raised some years ago, he said, there is no question that God helps us by means of his word. The word was written by the Spirit, and the Spirit of God is in that word, and the Spirit is available to us in that word. And after 40 minutes of such a delineation, he said, now, with all that I have said, he said, I'll never forget these words, with all that I have said, I am not saying for one moment that God cannot help us in our Bible study and cannot be with us to help us in that. And that's the balance. You leave your Bible on the shelf, God's not going to help you. Of course he's not. Nobody's suggesting he will. He won't just pot a whole lot of knowledge in our minds, will he? No way. But the person that does make access to his word and loves it, and as Brother Peirce always used to tell us when we were children, He always used to say, when you open that Bible, make prayer beforehand. Why? Because God then won't have anything to do with what you're doing? Nonsense. Just sheer nonsense. But we cannot delineate exactly how he might operate, can we? But that God is there is unequivocal. And that it's a response to our prayer. There can be no question. He's not out there. He is near to his people that seek him. In Psalm 119 and verse 18. Psalm 119 and verse 18. What does this one mean? Just one of many. Open thou mine eyes, that I may behold wondrous things out of thy law. What does that mean? Isn't that God helping that person in their understanding? It is God that worketh in you both to will and to do. Not taking over that person, but there's a cooperative spirit between man and God. Man asks for help. He asks for guidance. God doesn't leave him alone. He responds to that person. And I have a whole list of passages that fit very beautifully this sense of Isaiah 26 and verse 12. And I mention that tonight because it's a balance on a subject which needs a balance. Sometimes we hear people want to sort of lock God up in little formulae about what he can do and what he can't do. We're not entitled to do that. We've got to take the whole balance of Scripture into our consideration in those matters. Now, verse 13 says, O Yahweh our God, other lords beside thee have had dominion over us, but by thee only will we make mention of thy name. Now the other lords would be like the Assyrians or the Syrians or the Egyptians that in previous years had had lordship over Israel. But he says, but by thee only will we make mention of thy name. We have not got respect unto any other lords. The RSV says for the last little passage there, it says, thee only will we acknowledge, where it says, but by thee only will we make mention of thy name. Again, the sense is pretty hard to grasp, isn't it? But the RSV says simply, but thee only will we acknowledge. And I'm sure that is the sense. They had lordship over Israel, but Israel regards none of them except Yahweh himself. Only he is the Lord that they will recognize. They are dead, verse 14. They shall not live. They are deceased. They will receive no resurrection. They shall not rise. Therefore hast thou visited and destroyed them and made all their memory, their remembrance, to perish. Our desire is to thy name, verse 8, and to thy remembrance. When their remembrance is gone, all their stated objectives have dissolved in ruins. He said Ozymandias, remember that poem Ozymandias? Who wrote Ozymandias? Does anybody remember now? That great Egyptian god that was found in the desert, and he was fallen down, and the little poem was made about him. You know, there's a statement of his greatness. You know, Ozymandias, king of kings, there he was, fallen in the ruins and heat of the Egyptian desert. Ozymandias, king of kings, his arms fallen off and he was in the sands. Somebody made a little poem about that. See, they are dead, they shall not live, they are deceased, they shall not rise. Now of course there's a doctrinal import in that, isn't there? Verse 14 is saying that some will never rise. The idea of universal resurrection cannot be right, can it? See that? That is against the principle of universal resurrection. They are dead, they will not rise. It must mean what it says. Of course, there's many other passages which agree with that. But quickly, Psalm 49. just turn up this one, and I'll give you a couple of others just to fill in your margin a bit there. Psalm 49, verse 14. Speaking of the wicked, it says in verse 14, like sheep they are laid in the grave, death shall feed on them, and the upright shall have dominion over them in the resurrection morning, and their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. Verse 20, man that is in honour and understandeth not is like the beasts that perish. Now, do you want three or four others? Psalm 37, verse 20. Job 14, verse 12. And Psalm 88, verse 5. And the contrast of these in verse 14, the contrast is those of verse 19. Thy dead men shall live, together with my dead body shall they arise. See? They are deceased, they shall not rise. These others in verse 19 will rise. Thou hast made all their memory to perish. And that, of course, is very similar. No doubt this is taken from what passage in Ecclesiastes? Sorry? Ecclesiastes 9, that's right. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 5, for the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. I had two Mormons last night, my dear brothers and sisters. You can only thank God that you know the truth. Do you know that they not only think that man goes on after death, but they also think that he was always, always eternal. So I said to these two elders who were telling me these things, I said, well, tell me, what was it like? Oh. I said, where were you? And, don't really know. Finally, I said, well, how do you know you were there? They didn't know what it was like. They didn't know who was there. They didn't know in what form they were. And they didn't know... Who else was there anyway? Well, then how do you know you had that experience? It's an absolute amazing nonsense. And what's more, they think they have eternal life forever and ever. They have God's life forever and ever. Do you know that? The eternity of God is what they think they have. They were always in existence. I said, what are you saying? That you've always been going? And they said, yes. I said, how do you know that? That got pretty hard to answer. They turned to Jeremiah 1 verse 5, you know, that before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. Before I formed thee in the womb, I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations. I said, well, you know, he was ordained, yes, a prophet unto the nations. God had a purpose with him and therefore could see that, and therefore in that sense knew him. That's used of many people, but that's not proving your case, surely. Is that your passage? We can be very thankful to have the truth, my word. What a magnificent thing it is to have all that clear, that life starts when you're born, doesn't it? And that basic understanding that Brother Thomas gave us, that man is mortal. The same word, nephesh kaya, that all our young people, all our Sunday school students know this like the back of their hand. Nephesh kaya, living soul, from which they base all of their great towers of hypotheses. It's all the same phrase as is used of the animals on numerous occasions. And I kindly pointed these out to these boys and they're just stunned. I said, tell me, have the fish always been going? For all eternity? Oh, no, they haven't, no. I said, well, isn't this the same phrase? I don't know. I said, well, let's look it up. So I looked up, you see. It's a very sad thing, though, isn't it? Very sad thing. Earnest boys, well-dressed, very pleasant in the way they approached. And that's a lesson, too, for us all. Very pleasant, very proper in the way they approached. But boys and girls know the truth and be able to teach it. That's the power of that, isn't it? If we know the truth and yet we can't talk to people because we don't know it's nephesh kai and we don't know this and don't know that and therefore uncertain, can't quickly bring people to certain elements of the truth, then we're failing, aren't we? Those boys don't. They come from Salt Lake City to here and give 2 years of their life or more. And we do know the truth and we sit on our towers and can't give an answer of the hope that is within us.
Who do you respect?
In circumstances like that. To know the truth means we've got to know it. If we've got the truth, we must know it and be able to talk to other people about it in our daily life with confidence. All right, thou hast increased the nation, verse 15, when the others are dead and their memory perished, verse 15, thou hast increased the nation, O Yahweh, thou hast increased the nation. Well, it can't really mean the nation of Israel, I don't believe. It's the righteous nation of chapter 26, verse 2, which we saw before was made up of a gathered people taken from many people, didn't we? It's Peter's holy nation in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, or Moses' foolish nation in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 21. It's those references, or it's that nation which you have in chapter 24, verses 14 to 16. That were like little fires of truth and life and joy, singing unto Yahweh in all the utmost isles of the sea. Verses 14 to 16. Thou hast increased the nation. And even after AD 70, that nation was in a sense increased, wasn't it? For whilst the natural seed, the former children, were taken into captivity and their city ruined, yet the purpose of God marched on. The gospel of the Gentiles, the gospel to the Gentiles, was taken out by the Apostle Paul and all of his co-laborers and went far beyond, involving hundreds of thousands, millions of people in all that time. Thou hast increased the nation, O Yahweh. Thou hast increased the nation. Thou art glorified. Thou, and he was, see, chapter 24, verse 14, they shall sing for the majesty of Yahweh. Verse 16, from the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous one. Thou hast increased the nation. Thou art glorified. Thou hast removed it far unto the ends of the earth. There, of course, you have this sense of the gospel going out to the ends of the earth. As you've got in that 24th chapter, this then is an amplification of those things. And so verse 16, Yahweh, in trouble have they visited thee. They poured out a prayer when thy chastening was upon them. Like as a woman with child that draweth near the time of her delivery is in pain, and crieth out in her pangs, so have we been in thy sight, O Yahweh. This is not all the nation, is it? This is the faithful remnant that would be in Israel now, in Isaiah's time, and later on would be found around about the world until 1994, including ourselves, my dear brothers and sisters, we hope. Yahweh, in trouble have they visited thee, have they sought thee, says Revised Standard Version in Rotherham. Have they sought thee, and they poured out their prayer when thy chastening was upon them. And then we have that figure of the woman. A woman in child. Why should the prophet take that picture? See verse 18. We have been with child. It's not just the analogy of pain, verse 17. It says there is a child involved. We have been, hurrah, with child. Expectant. We have been in pain, close to delivery. We have, as it were, brought forth wind. The substance that we long for that might have been our deliverance was not found. We have not wrought any deliverance in the earth. We haven't been able to bring judgment upon the inhabitants of the world. They haven't fallen before us. Israel sought to see that vindication in their own time, but it never came. Because they never could bring forth that child. And later on the prophet picks that up in the 66th chapter, the last chapter. And he says the child will come. In the 66th chapter, I'll have to spend time with you with this after, but just quickly you might get the gist of it here. Isaiah 66, before she travailed, before Israel travailed in AD 70, before she travailed, she brought forth See what she couldn't do in chapter 26. Before her pain came, she was delivered of a mangel. That doesn't happen very often, does it? Ask our mothers that. She was delivered of a man-child, and that's very pertinent. It means a male. Not just a boy, not just a general word for man. It means specifically a male. Zakar. Z-A-K-A-R. And Jesus was born before the travail of AD 70. It's a strange thing. Who hath heard such a thing? Child comes after the pain, normally. Who hath seen such things? Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day? Or shall a nation be born at once? In him there were many people redeemed at once. You and I were redeemed in him. As there was one man of sin unto death, so there was one man of resurrection unto life. 1 Corinthians 15. They're all involved in him, aren't they? Here's the first and the last of those who were dead and are alive again. He's the first and the last of them. They are Christ's at his coming. They're in him. They're part of him. Part of his resurrection. As surely as he rose, they will rise. So when he rose, there was a nation brought forth at once, prospectively. Magnificently and powerfully and consummately. God has determined that. Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day? What magnificent things are these, says Isaiah, to bring forth in one day? Or shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, and the build up towards AD 70, she brought forth her children, her sons. One in verse 7, now many in verse 8. Shall I bring to the birth and not cause to bring forth, like you said in chapter 26, saith Yahweh? Shall I cause to bring forth and shut the womb, that there might just be wind? Rejoice, you with Jerusalem, and be glad with her, all you that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all you that mourn for her. She's seen there, you see, as a wonderful and productive and prosperous mother. That ye may suck and be satisfied with the breasts of her consolations. That ye may milk out and be delighted with the abundance of her glory. For thus saith Yahweh, behold, I'll extend peace to her like a river, and the glory of the Gentiles like a flowing stream. Then shall ye suck and be born, and shall be born upon her sides, and be dandled upon her knees, as one whom his mother comforteth. So will I comfort you, and ye shall be comforted in Jerusalem, the mother of us all. Isn't that absolutely beautiful? That's the answer, you see, of chapter 26. You've got to go on in 26 to 66. And it fills out all that picture. We'll have a talk about that later. But just tuck this one in your mind too. John 16. Because John 16 is a New Testament commentary upon it. But I won't do that now, even though it's magnificent. We'll have a talk about it after. Let's see if we can get through now these last few verses. As Brother Max said, I will finish. And I always do what I'm told. In Isaiah chapter 26 then and verse 19, there's the insufficiency implied in verse 17 and 18, our insufficiency. The whole creation groaneth and travaileth in birth. See? That's our insufficiency, isn't it? That's Romans 8, by the way, verses 19 to 23, a most apposite quotation for these expressions here. We can't do it ourselves. We have not made the inhabitants of the world to fall and brought about the vindication of God's name. Can't do it. We're mortal. We die, and our lives therefore fret away as it were in vanity and uselessness. We can't bring forth the child. Only God can bring forth the child. But when he brings forth that child, life comes with it. And so in verse 19, sweeping away the inadequacy, sweeping away the weakness, the pain, the emptiness, the vanity of mortal life, a voice says this: thy dead men shall live. And Isaiah's in it too. Together with my dead body shall they arise when the others are dead. Did you see that, my dear brothers and sisters? Who are these of whom he speaks? thy dead men. Is God the God of the dead? Jesus said he is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. What was he proving when he said that? Immortal souls? Nonsense. He was proving resurrection. And so he called himself the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, because those men are living unto him, though they're dead. They're dead and waiting in the grave. But they live unto him in his mind. They're in his book. They are memorial graves, as he calls them in John 5 and verse 28. Memorial graves. Remember, that spot there is where Abraham died, and he will surely come to that place and he will take Abraham from it. That's where David died, and he'll come to that place and he'll rebuild David. He remembers him. That's where the apostles died, and he will go to that place and he'll rebuild those men. And there's Isaiah, and he will rebuild him and all of his family. He'll rebuild them. Thy dead men shall live, says Isaiah, and I with them. And we will rise together with my dead body. Isn't that absolutely beautiful? Absolutely beautiful. A man that had given all he could and more, all he could to God's cause, had this wonderful reassurance, it's going to be worth it. God is not going to leave behind his dead men. Their own time will come. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living, and all them live unto him. How beautiful the commentary of Jesus there in Mark chapter 12 upon that verse. Well, that's Isaiah's statement of glorious belief. You think about that of the people that we know and love in times past, my dear and sisters. People of this meeting. People of our own relationships and those that we've known in this city and in other places. Eh? What a glorious statement. And look at the thrust of this verse. This now is God's words. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust. For thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. Do you know any more emphatic statement of resurrection than that? The earth shall cast out the dead. They won't crawl out over the dust and over piles of ruin, will they? God will cast out the dead. The zeal of Yahweh of hosts will perform this. That's what it means. According to the working of his mighty power is Paul's expression of the resurrection of Jesus in, I think it's Ephesians 1 and verse 20. A lovely phrase. I always love that phrase. According to the working of his mighty power, when he brought forth Jesus out of that grave, he turned the stone back and he brought his son forth. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust. There's your grandma, or your mother, or your father. There's Brother Thomas. There's the protesters. And they come out of that grave and they're singing. There's a sense of victory upon their very note. They come to sing. Thy dew is as the dew of herbs. They're fresh as the morning. You know the story of the dew that comes down? Brother Thomas had beautiful things to say about that. Thy dew is as the dew of herbs. When you go out in the morning, there it is, resting upon the leaves of the ground. There's nothing so emblematic of a new morning, of freshness and vigour and glory, beauty and cleanness. Isaiah, I haven't forgotten you, and I won't forget them. Wake and sing, ye that dwell in dust. Dwell in dust. Aren't they dead? Dead in dust? No, they're dwelling in dust. Because it's like a sleep, see? The earth shall cast out the dead. And so as an invitation, God says in verse 20, come my people, thy dead men, verse 19, are my people. He owns them. Isn't that beautiful? My people. In that context, isn't that beautiful? Come my people, enter thou into thy chambers and shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment. There's Paul's little moment of 2 Corinthians 4:17. The affliction which is but for a little moment. Hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation be overpast. Now, I'm suggesting to you that those words are speaking about the memorial grave. The chamber is the chamber of the grave. Can I illustrate where I think it comes from? You might see why I feel convinced of that. Job chapter 14. These are Job's words. Job has some outstanding statements about resurrection. We know chapter 19. Well, this is chapter 14. Poor old Job, he went up and down, didn't he? But this is some of his really high notes. Job 14, verse 13. Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in the grave. Hide me in the grave. Shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment. See? So there's your first comparison. That thou wouldst keep me secret. Shut thy doors about thee. Until thy wrath be past, until the indignation be overpast. That thou wouldest appoint me a set time and remember me when the little moment has gone, and when God will say to them, awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust. So he would have set me appointed time and remember me. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. And there's Paul's expression. We shall not all, 1 Corinthians 15, we shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed, as his word. It comes from here. It's also at the end of Isaiah chapter 40, where he speaks about the change, we shall renew our strength, and that word means change. It's the same word as what we've got here. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait. Where? In the memorial grave, in the chamber where he dwells in dust. See, you dwell in a chamber, don't you? You dwell in dust, you dwell in a chamber. It's not being looked upon then, you see, as just a pile of dirt. It's being looked upon as a place where God has his people. Don't you worry about death. After what I promised, it's got no sting, no power at all. Just come, come willingly. Come without fear. Come without anxiety. Like we saw people die in recent times. I've seen people on the very verge of death, just exactly like that, completely reconciled. Brother John's mother was a glowing example recently. Perfectly reconciled, utterly reconciled to her lot, and gloriously believing in the redemption by resurrection that God will bring in the time when his son comes. Totally reconciled. That's how Job was. All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change came. Thou shalt call Lazarus, come forth. There's a prototype of what's going to happen. Thou shalt call. And John says the same thing, doesn't he, in his fifth chapter again. He says that all they that are in the memorial graves shall hear my voice. He will stand there like he did on the day when he was in Bethany, and he will call them forth. Thou shalt call, awake ye that dwell in dust, and sing. And I will answer thee. I'll come out of the grave, springing out of the grave, not clambering over the clods of earth, gradually put together, but coming forth with divine power, according to the working whereby he is able to transform all things unto himself, says Paul again in Philippians. Thou would have a desire to the work of thine hands. That's the other little point, isn't it? God's not going to let us slip into the grave because he's been working with us. If you've been working with your children, my dear brother and sister, you let them just slip away. You've invested years and time and thought and love and care. You can't, can you? You can't do it. Neither can he. Thou wilt have respect on the work of thy hands. Thou hast wrought all these things in us, says Isaiah. We haven't been here alone. It isn't all our own work. So come, my people, in confidence of resurrection. When the indignation's overpast, that will be your time. For behold, verse 21, Yahweh cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. He's going to do it in the day that you're vindicated. And the earth shall disclose her blood. The earth shall cast out the dead. Verse 19. The earth also shall disclose her blood. God will vindicate them all right with divine vengeance. Vengeance is mine. I will repay. Strength in that statement. And shall no more cover her slain. And so we have that beautifully taken up, as we have in other times in the book of Revelation, which shows us this is the time of the marriage supper of the Lamb, the uniting of God and his people together in wonderful harmony, when the judgments of God have finally vindicated that cause. My dear brothers and sisters, there's a terrific spiritual, moral overtones to us in our daily life, isn't there? You can't feel like that. We go home tonight, and Brother Max will pray now at the close of this meeting. If we pray for the judgments of God, we've got to be on the right side, don't we? Tremendous moral implications. If we go home, we waste our time. If we rise tomorrow and we're no different than ever before, if we fret away our time and our thought in things that are vain and no profit, if our ecclesial life is too much trouble for us, then we can't pray like Isaiah, can we? If God's going to come and judge and he's going to make discernment, he's not going to be a respecter of persons. He's not going to say, oh, just a minute, I was going to condemn you, but I see you're a Christadelphian. He's not going to say that, is he? He's going to know what that person is and what they do with their life and where their mind has been. Isaiah was confident because his life was in God. His family, I and the children which God hath given me, are for signs and for wonders. When we think, therefore, of the judgments of God, it's a tremendously helpful matter in sorting ourselves out. You know, my dear brothers and sisters, the truth is there's far too much preoccupation, isn't there, with some other things. This hall would never be like this otherwise. Never, ever. In the latter days, that's an increasing feature in ecclesial life. And what we've got to resolve is that whatever is on here, and this is the very least, is it not? Whatever is on here, we're there with 2 feet, shoving and pushing and making joy and happiness and power in this place to keep the truth burning. And in our personal lives, to go home and use our time, to get up tomorrow, to use that day in the glory of God. And then we can say with Isaiah, Yahweh, in the way of thy judgments have I thought upon thy name.